Am I supposed to hand out this this book? Good. That's excellent. Let's pray. Father, thank you for bringing us here this evening, and I just pray that as we look at your word, that we would hear you speak. And Father, I pray that that your face would be the face that we would seek, and that the knowledge of you would be foremost in our desire, that we would learn of you and from you, and that we would be all that you would have us be, that we would respond to you. Father, you know us because you made us, and so you know our weaknesses and you know our frailty, and you know mine especially well because it's always before you. And so, Father, I pray that you would work in our weaknesses, and that we would hear you in the words that we speak to each other, the worship, the music, the art, the expressions of the artists and the poets, and that we would find you tonight. I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen. One of my things that I do every New Year is I think about New Year's resolutions. I think about them. I used to make them, but then I found out that you have to keep them if you make them. So now I just think about them, and it's a lot easier. And especially one year I actually told some people my resolutions. Then they held me accountable to them, which is really, really stupid. So never, ever make your resolutions known to people, because when you do that, then they actually expect you to keep them. I made the resolution to lose weight one year, and there were some people from the Good Egg restaurant that were sitting in the service, and the next day when I went to the Good Egg for breakfast, they had Rod's New Year's resolution. And it was like granola and oatmeal and, you know, healthy stuff, you know. And so I stopped announcing my resolutions, and I'm not going to announce them tonight because you would hold me accountable. And we know we don't want that. And so, but a while back, Eric and I were talking at an elders meeting. We actually do that. And how to fix our sound system so that we constantly don't bug out. But anyway, beyond that, we were also talking about, Eric asked me a question, and I don't know how he phrased it, and I'm sure I have it all wrong, but the general tone of the conversation and the question was, why do we live good lives? Why do we do good things? Why are we hoping to make people into Christians? Now, I understand the long-term benefits, you know, the heaven thing, but does it make a difference here and now? What difference does it really make? If I live like hell here or live like heaven here, what difference does it make? Because, and the further part of that conversation was, if our best works are filthy rags, and that's what Isaiah 60 verse 6 says, that our righteous works, our best righteous works, are just filthy rags. If the very best we can do is filthy rags, then you know, can I? So what? Then why even bother? You know, if in my greatest, finest moments, I'm still just turning out filthy rags. It's like God has an overabundance of those, and so he doesn't need some more of mine. So then why do I even try to do good things? Why do I even try to do good works? Why do I even live this godly life? And what is that all about? And we talked about it for a long time, but it also strikes me that in the New Testament that Jesus talks about the seed that falls on the good soil, and he says, the good soil is a good and noble heart. So if the best, if my best works are filthy rags, but I can have this good and noble heart, what's the transition? What changes? What's that focal point? And I think it is that Jesus comes in and invades our lives. And somehow, some way, sometime when he does that, my filthy rags get cleaned up and they become good and beautiful things from a good and noble heart. So the reason that we want you to follow God is so that you can do good and noble things. But even that can seem kind of meaningless. And tonight I want to look at the book of Ecclesiastes. And Ecclesiastes is one of my favorite and least favorite books. I love it because I so relate to it. And I despise it because it's just so blatantly raw and painful as I look at my own life and then look at the life of the writer of Ecclesiastes. We're not sure who the writer is. He's a man known as the teacher. He's a son of David. There's speculation that he's Solomon. We don't really know that. In chapter 1, it says, verse 1, the words of the teacher, a son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. And there are most days at age 50 where I really wanted to agree with that, that it's just meaningless. You know, I get up, I go about my business, I do the same old things, or I don't. Nothing seems to change. It's no big deal. And everything becomes meaningless. Everything becomes routine. Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails wrote a song that Johnny Cash recorded. And it is a powerful, powerful song. Johnny Cash not only recorded the song, but he filmed a video that goes with it. And I think I want to show that video clip tonight because I want you to see kind of, there's something powerful about a guy like Johnny Cash just before he died, that this is kind of his last hit, his last great song. And I want you to just watch it, and then we'll talk about it a little bit more if we can click onto that. In the middle. In the middle. Way up. Up, 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 up. There you go.
Much more obvious than the big one.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar stain. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything. What have I become? My sweetest friend. Everyone I know goes away in the end. And you could have it all. Dirt. I will let you down. squire's chair, full of broken thoughts. I cannot repair beneath the stains of time. The feelings disappear. You are someone else. I am still right here. What have I become? My sweetest friend. Everyone I know goes away in the end. And you could have it all. My empire of dirt. I will let you down. I will make you run. If I could start again, a million miles away, I would keep myself. I would find a way.
Man who we look up to, who has it all, has everything that a lot of us would long for, and it's an empire of dirt. That strikes me at age 50 in a new year. Of all the things that I pursue, all the things that I look for, all the things that I think will bring me happiness and joy and the best of life. And when I look and when I watch that video, and I watch it numerous times, I'm just struck by the starkness of it and the pain of it. In Ecclesiastes 1, 1 through 16, you see a little bit of what this writer of the book of Ecclesiastes is talking about. He says, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever turning in its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams came from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear to fill its hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already, long ago. It was here before our time. There is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. Those words are the words of a very, very depressed man. A man who has looked everywhere. And he goes on and he pursues chapter 2, verse 1. He talks about pursuing pleasure, laughter, good cheer. He mentions wine. You know, if maybe we can just laugh our way through. You know, in that first section, he talks about wisdom and then the madness and the folly. That you either pursue wisdom, or you pursue just craziness, folly, stupidness, just the, and then what difference does it make? That you pursue pleasure and laughter and good cheer. Maybe if I just laugh enough, if I can find enough humor. Some of the saddest people in the world are comedians. Isn't that interesting? In chapter 2, verse 4, I'll build great projects, houses, gardens. I'll build things. I'll build monuments. I'll build things that last. I'll look for the great things. Chapter 2, verse 8, money, gold, silver. If I just have enough money, if I just have enough stuff, if I just get my wealth, then I'll be happy. Verse 8 also talks about music, also talks about sex. If I just pursue, you know, the arts, if I just pursue sexual expression, if I just pursue that all the way to the end. Chapter 2, verse 9, if I pursue greatness. And then verse 10 talks about excess, if I do this to excess. In other words, if I go all the way. I have a friend who told me that the reason he's not a Christian is because of the book of Ecclesiastes. So I said, okay, let's talk about that. And I'm interested in why you would read the book of Ecclesiastes and come to the conclusion that you should not be a Christian. And he said, well, he said, I don't like a God who has a world that he's created that's as meaningless as all of this. And he said, and I do believe that there are those things that we can pursue that will bring us what we really long for. He says, my only problem is that this was written by a king. He said, until I read that it was written, the book was written by a king, I assumed that I could pursue wealth, I could pursue sexual expression, I could pursue pleasure, I could pursue money, I could pursue all these things, and then I would find happiness. But he said, when I found out that this man was a king, that stopped me in my tracks. And he said, because a king can do whatever he pleases. King has all the money in the world. King has, especially if this was Solomon, I mean, you know, 700 wives and 300 concubines. I mean, talk about sexual expression. He had wealth. He didn't just build towers. He built cities, huge cities. And everything paved in gold and adorned with every beautiful gem there was. Solomon had it all. So if it's possible to get it all, my friend says, then he said, so then I'm just not sure. And he said that once I read that, I got pretty depressed because a king could do all this. I said, okay, so far you give me a lot of reasons why you would believe. I'm not sure that I still understand the reason why you don't believe. And his thing was, well, I don't think he pursued wisdom all the way to its end. I think maybe if I use my intellect and if I read enough and study enough, I might find what I'm looking for at the end of that. The writer of Ecclesiastes talks about excess. And then he gets depressed. And he notes that whether we're wise or we're foolish, we die. You know, really wise people, really smart people die. And so do really stupid people. Now, sometimes stupid people die a little quicker. But it doesn't matter how smart you are, you're going to die. If it doesn't matter how rich I am or how poor I am, rich people die, poor people die. It doesn't matter the beautiful music or the great art that I produce or the great buildings that I build or the great monuments. People who do those, all are dead. Matter of fact, we often name the buildings after them. You know, Carnegie Hall. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. Now, the named after somebody, but slowly disappearing into the, until someday the building falls apart, leaves. It's all circular. And we anxiously strive for what does not bring pleasure. We keep pursuing that which does not give us pleasure. In chapter 2, verse 24, it says, eat, drink, and find satisfaction in your work. That's kind of where you end up. If I eat, if I drink, and I find some satisfaction in the job that I do, then I'm okay. But when I look around, most of us are dissatisfied with our jobs. And we're dissatisfied with what we eat, especially on this Atkins diet. You know, we don't like what we have. If you have the scene in the Hurt video, it's so powerful when he, you know, all these amazing foods, things that some of us just long for that day when we could actually taste, you know, something like that, and he just pours out the wine, and it's just wasted. It gives no pleasure. There comes that time when it gives no pleasure. And then in chapter 3, verse 11, the writer of Ecclesiastes talks about a strange phenomena, that God has placed eternity in our hearts. That he's placed eternity in our hearts. He's given us something more than what we can see and know. If we did not have eternity in our hearts, if we did not know that there was more, then this would be a miserable, sad existence. It would be a horrible existence if we didn't know that there was something more. Now, the problem is that this eternity that's been set in our hearts is such that we can't fathom it. We can't get our brains around it. I mean, have you ever thought, I made the mistake of going over to Eric and Susan's for breakfast the other morning, and Brian and Sarah were there, and we got to talking about the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and we have a whole theology behind that now. But anyway, which you can ask Eric about. But we were talking about not being able to even get our minds around the concept of what heaven is going to be like. Not to be able to get our minds around even the concept of who God is. We all have this picture of who God is and this idea of who God is, but it's so limited because it's limited by our brains and it's limited by our concepts and it's limited, if nothing else, by language itself. I mean, how do we describe to each other the incredible experiences that we have with God, of God, or even of nature, or even of those around us? How do we describe that? What words can we use? That's why poetry exists, because actual descriptors just don't cut it. And so we come up with picture and metaphor and image, and we hope that somehow that conveys something bigger, something beyond. The writer says that God has set eternity in our hearts, but we're unable to fathom it. We're unable to measure it. The word fathom is to measure it. So in a very real way, we're unable to get our arms around it. And if that's not true, then what follows is in 18 to 21 is that man has no advantage over the animals. I mean, if it's not for the fact that we have eternity in us, a greater view, a greater vision, just something beyond, at least the understanding that there's something beyond, then we have no advantage over the animals. Then we're not the king of creation. We're just part of the creation. In chapter 4, which which I can't find. It says, I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors, and they have no comforter. And I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun. That evil somehow invades us, that there's this reality that we live in a world that is torn apart by people who are after power, by people who sin. And you know what? We keep looking out there like those people exist somewhere other than in this room. That we are those people. That we are those people who are capable of incredible evil, incredible doing wrong. And so if it's true that there's not something beyond, then still, why do we live in the present? Why do I stay alive? I mean, we often have a joke at Teen Challenge when we get some rough characters every once in a while, and we always say, well, we should lead them to Christ and then just shoot them quickly so that they'll go directly to heaven, and then we won't have to put up with all the shenanigans that we know we're going to have to go through in the next little while. You know what? I used to think that that was just a Teen Challenge thing, but that's not. You know what? I've met some villagers, too, that are just like that, right? We just need to lead you to Christ and then, you know, have a little guillotine out here so that you get it, and then you get to whatever that permanent real thing is that's beyond here. Okay, that was rough. And I... And I don't, you know, I'm very unserious about that. But you know what? It is. It's very, very, very frustrating to see those of us who get it and then go back and sort of get it and sort of go back and just teeter on this constant edge of sort of thinking into the future and seeing that which is real and big and great and beyond us, living in that eternity that's set in our hearts, and then going back to that reality of what we live in every day. And in this chapter, chapter 4, you also see the incredible loneliness, the reality of our loneliness. Even in our best relationships, they are contaminated by sin. They are contaminated by our own arrogance and pride and wanting stuff. And so we even the most intimate of relationship that we can have here does not bring fulfillment, does not bring that which we really want. In chapter 5, chapter 5, verse 2, it says, do not be quick with your mouth. Do not be hasty in your heart to utter anything before God. God is in heaven and you are on earth, so let your words be few. As a dream comes when there are many cares, so the speech of a fool when there are many words. Don't be quick with your mouth before God. Don't talk before him. Don't utter things before him. He's in heaven, you're on earth. And that's that mentality that we finally get to where we say, okay, then it's just hopeless. God is big and huge and beyond and impossible to touch and impossible to impact. And he doesn't care what I do and he doesn't care how I live and he doesn't enter into the affairs of men. And so it doesn't matter what I say, doesn't matter what I do, doesn't matter how I live. Either God is or he isn't. Either he's close or, I mean, either he, you know, figures it all out in the end and takes me or he doesn't. There's really nothing I can do about it. We get into that nihilistic, I might as well just kill myself because what difference does it make? What difference does it really make? All our appetites are never satisfied. It says in chapter 6 that we stay hungry, we stay thirsty, we stay longing. So if I leave off with this message now, it's a pretty depressing message. And we say, well, then why do we even go into this new year? I mean, really, what is the point? And there's a little verse that I have missed a lot of times when I've read this book. And it's an amazing verse because I think it... It says no. It says to me, if I can find it now. Oh, verse 7 of chapter 5. This little verse says, "Much dreaming and many words are meaningless." And this is kind of at the end of all of his explanation of just how meaningless everything is. He says, "Much dreaming and many words are meaningless." And then he says these words, "Therefore, stand in awe of God." What? That makes no sense. If everything is meaningless, then stand in awe of God? I mean, if everything is meaningless, and we've gone on for chapter after chapter after chapter of everything being meaningless, then the last thing we want to do is stand in awe of God. Then I want to be angry with God. I want to be frustrated with God. I want to be upset with God. I want to curse God and die, as Job almost did, or at least his wife encouraged him to. He walked right up to that edge. I mean, we get to that point where we go, what? And it says, no, stand in awe of God. And that word therefore, in that, you know, Eric always teases me about using the word therefore, but I love transitions. And transitions are very important. And when he says the word therefore, he's saying, therefore, in spite of everything that's come before this, in spite of my total depressed 6 chapters of, or 5.5 chapters of writing, he says, listen to me now. Stand in awe of God. Standing in awe of God means to very literally be shocked by him, be surprised by him. But to stand in deep respect for. In other words, be so blown away that you literally are flat on your face in awe before God. It's that image that the writer is trying to tell us. He says, therefore, basically throw yourself down at the feet of God. Therefore, stand before him empty, naked, lonely, depressed, whatever baggage you bring, stand before him with all that, with the understanding that either God does it or I'm dead. Either there's purpose in him or there is no purpose. Some of us still search for purpose outside of God. It does not exist. We can pretend it does, and we can talk about it, and we can pursue it, and we can pursue it to its extent, but there is no meaning, no purpose outside of that intimate relationship with God. So then, Eric's question, which we talked about, is, so why do I live a good life even after I've given my life to Christ? Even if I come to God, even if I follow this path that Jesus made and I come to him and I stand in awe of him and I'm just standing there. You know what? You can't just stand still for the rest of your life. Okay, I'm standing here. I'm in awe. Hello, God. Wow, God, you're amazing. You know, we just stand there and stand there and stand there. It's like, now what? Now what? Now what? And for that, we have to go to the last verses of Ecclesiastes. Chapter 12, verse 13 says, "Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments." For this is the whole duty of man. Fear God and keep his commandments. That word fear is an active fear. It's a I stand in fear of, but I stand, but I'm. It's a moving fear. It's a fear that I'm doing something, and that thing that I'm doing is keeping his commandments. You say, well, but keeping the commandments is meaningless. Didn't we already talk about all that, all the purposelessness? No, there's something very real about keeping God's commandments, about honoring God with what we do, so that our actions of keeping his commandments. So what are God's commandments? Well, we know the Big Ten. Well, some of us do. Some of us may need a refresher course. You can go look them up. Exodus chapter 20, Deuteronomy chapter 5, list them. The Big Ten, the ones that everybody gets excited about in America today, those 10, but there's a whole bunch of other commandments. And what's the real commandment? The master commandment. Love God and love people. So when God says, when the writer says, fear God and keep his commandments, what he's saying is, fear God and love people and love God. Love requires action. Love is never passive. Some of us get to believing that. We say those words so often. Oh, I love you. Oh, I love that person. I just love. But we don't do. Our actions don't show that we love. Those words very quickly become as meaningless as the rest of the writer of Ecclesiastes' words. Love is action. If you want to know what it reads like and what it feels like to love, go read 1 Corinthians 13. It describes love, and it's always active. Love is always active. It always moves. It always does things. Fear God and keep his commandments to love, to honor, to cherish. Our loving God and our loving each other is where we find meaning in our life. It is not in our pursuit of wealth. And it's not in our pursuit of great monuments in our name. And it's not in pursuit of knowledge and wisdom. It's not in pursuit of great sex. It is in pursuit of loving people. That's what this community is here for. For us to practice our loving skills, to practice the commandment, to love each other. So how do you do that? What resolutions ought you to make for this new year? You know what? I've noticed something strange about resolutions. They're always narcissistic. Every resolution that I've ever looked at has been a resolution that is about me. I'm going to lose weight this year. I'm going to, you know, buy the new car this year, I'm going to, you know, whatever the thing is. Every resolution, I'm going to read more books, I'm going to become smarter. Have you really thought about whatever resolutions you ever make? Do you realize how narcissistic we are? That there are resolutions that have only to do with us? Now, we kind of think that maybe someone else will benefit from them. You know, if I lose weight, you know, my wife might like me better or whatever, but even that's about me, right? It's not about her. So make some vows this year, resolutions this year. Don't make vows. Those are not good. Make resolutions this year. Matter of fact, we already talked about that. Don't make vows unless you intend to keep them. God's real serious about vows. But resolve this year. Now, we understand about our resolve. Hosea talks about it. Our resolve is like the morning mist. You know, it's as soon as the sun comes out, it's gone. So, you know what? This resolution may only last till like the end of January. You know, it's no big deal. But resolve to do that which would encourage others in the community. Resolve to do that which the others in the community would find a loving action from you, a selfless action. Make a New Year's resolution that's completely selfless for you and fulfilling for someone else in the community. It's going to be hard. I mean, you have to think of that. You're going to have to actually work, you know, get all those little brain cells moving, all that wisdom that you were pursuing. You have to use some of that to find ways to resolve, to help, to love, to obey, to offer. That's what God's calling us to. And when you do that, an amazingly narcissistic thing will happen. You'll find meaning in your life. You'll find meaning. You want to search for meaning? You want to find out what it's all about? Stand in awe of God, fear Him, and keep His commandments. Let's pray. Father, help us to resolve to not look just to ourselves, to not look to our own needs, our own desires, our own passions. Father, we see, at least those of us who pay careful attention, how meaningless all this can be. Father, help us to stand in awe of you. Help us this year to go face first before you and say, okay, I give up. Take it all. Take all of me, every bit of it. And then, Father, help us to stand up and pursue the person sitting next to us, the person across the room. Father, maybe the person who isn't here tonight. Help us to honor your command to love, the greatest commands, to love our neighbor and to love you, so that we can find purpose